Hello, welcome to Dark Materials. I'm Faye. Hi.
And I'm Rachel. Hello.
This is a podcast where we're reading through and discussing Philip Pullman's His Dark Materials novels, a chapter at a time, spoiler free.
In this episode, we're talking about chapter 35 of The Amber Spyglass, Over the Hills and Far Away. Three little ducks went swimming one day over the hills and far away. That's all I can think of when I read this.
I was wondering where I knew that from. And there we go. You've just confirmed
Except
it for
me.
Except
for this is not about little ducks going missing and a search party being launched. This is not about ducks at all.
It is not. There is no mention of a duck in this chapter, unfortunately.
Not at all. How are you doing, Faye?
I'm okay, thank you. I'm good. I'm like frazzled and busy as always, but yeah, good, good. I turned 32 recently.
What?
I don't know if you know.
How dare you? How exciting.
Yeah, it was good. It was good. I'm old now.
She's old now. Mm-hmm. We had a really lovely time there. We watched a bunch of spooky movies at your house.
We did.
And despite being a massive scaredy cat, none of them were too scary for me, I don't think.
Yeah, you did really well. Although we watched Exorcism of Emily Rose, and I remember that being like super scary when I originally watched it, which I think really shows, because it wasn't scary at all, I think really shows how much horror has progressed since that point, that when I watched it, I was like, oh my God, that's horrifying. And now we're all just a bit like, meh.
Yeah. Like, I think I watch TV shows that are billed as being, like, spooky, that are more scary than that actual thing that's billed as being a horror movie.
They did a thing with that film where they try and make it rooted more in reality, so they make it a court case, but then they make it too much about the court case and it gets boring.
Mm. Also, Laura Linney wears some really bad wigs.
Oh, she does. She does, indeed. She really does. But, yeah. And then what else did you watch? Final Destination 3, which I really enjoyed.
Yeah, I've not seen that one before all the way through, I don't think. Mm. I love a Final Destination. I love how, like, despite, I mean, it's less so, I feel like, in the third one. They really, like, go for it in the first one with, like, hamming up the whole, like, oh, Death's angry that you didn't die in the plane crash. And, like, the personification of, like, the shampoo that makes the guy slip over.
Yeah.
Like, it kills me and I love it.
Yeah.
They don't do it as much in the third one, but there's still some good, like, good deaths in it.
Yeah, there's some great deaths in it. Yeah, and then we watched Strangers, which, it was all right.
And once I found out after watching it, because you know me, I am an ADHD IMDb scroller. Well, I love a bit of trivia during and, and after a film.
I'm with you. I do love a bit of film triv.
Yes. And the fact that Liv Tyler had tonsillitis or laryngitis or something through filming, which is why she does just whisper the whole film. Because I found it annoying and then I found that out and I was like, oh, fair enough.
See, this is the thing. I'm also very aware of whether I find a woman annoying in a film because of my internalized misogyny, or whether I find a woman annoying in a film because she was written by a man.
Yeah.
So it's probably a little bit of both. And I hate to say it now. Back in the day when I thought I was being cool and like one of the boys, I'd be like, oh my God, she's so annoying. It hasn't happened in a while, but whilst watching that, I did find her character a little bit annoying and the voice was part of it. So to know that she couldn't help it, it helps, you know?
It is an interesting one, isn't it?
Yeah.
I feel like usually the answer is yes, she was just badly written by a man.
Yes.
So.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, so, folks, you know that we have been a little bit flaky recently. We've had a lot going on in our lives. We've had to push a couple of episodes back. We've just come back from a little break because we had to have a week off because we are very aware we're approaching the end of these books and we want to be on our best, not best behaviour, top form. We want to be on top form for you. And so we've recollected ourselves and written out a little winter schedule so you know what to expect towards the end of this year and the beginning of next year and for how it's going to look as we finish this third book. terrifying. I was saying to Faye earlier, oh my God, we've been covering this book since August 2021. That is how long this book is, and the fact that we paused in the middle to cover the TV show. Anyway, the winter schedule. You are listening to this episode right now that has come out on November the 13th, Over the Hills and Far Away. Your next episode will be chapter 36, Broken Arrow, on November 27th. December 11th, you're getting chapter 37. And then we're having a break because it's the festive period. We all need a little break, and we'll be back in the new year with the final chapter. And that feels quite like we'll be rested, we'll be relaxed, we'll be full of turkey and stuffing and all of the mulled wine, and hopefully not in the midst of the January blues.
Hopefully
we bring you the final chapter, Botanic Garden, and when we all just cry for about 2 hours straight.
Yes.
Then we'll run a little wrap-up episode where we talk about all things Amber Spyglass and our big feelings on January 22nd. And February 5th, we will bring out the lantern slides, because we do love a little lantern slide moment in these books.
We do. We do. And it is wild to think that we're this close to the end. I feel like, simultaneously, I don't want it to be the end, but also, isn't it wild how long we've been doing this for? It's been like 4 years for the whole thing. And also, you told me this today that we've been doing the Amber Spyglass since 2021.
Right? August 2021 is wild. This is such a long book.
Yeah.
And I also think that's why we've needed a few more breaks, because we're not used to covering 38 chapters in a row.
With a lot of like intense, it's the last book in the series, so there's a lot of intense information, a lot of storylines wrapping up. It's kind of hard to get your head around talking about it in the way that we talk about it. So we've found ourselves burnt out a little bit, I guess, obviously with all the other stuff going on in our lives as well. Yeah. It's tough.
It's been a year.
I know. It has been.
Yeah,
a year.
The fact that the first book is 23 chapters.
Mm-hmm.
First book is 23 chapters. Second book is only, I think, 15 chapters. So the fact that this one is 38 that's a lot more book.
It's a lot more book. It
so,
really
yeah,
is.
We would apologise for having taken a few more breaks than we anticipated, but we're not going to be sorry for taking the rest that we need.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a thing that you should all do too.
Yay! Agreed.
And we're going to try our best to stick to the schedule that I just outlined for you. There's a cute little info schedule thing on our social media, on Instagram and Twitter, if you want to check in and see what you can expect over the next few months. We're going to try our best to stick to it. But we're also not going to make any promises, because we want to be on top form for bringing you the like end of this epic series. So.
That's the thing, isn't it? It's like we are super aware. I think, you know, in the past, just to be like completely transparent, we've had times where we've pushed through when maybe one of us or both of us were going through some things, and there's a whole, I barely remember the entirety of this whole knife. So. But I think with the end of the third book, and how important it is, we both just really want to be on top form. So if that
we want to
ends
do it
up,
justice.
Yeah, exactly. If that ends up us having to like rejig the schedule again, then we're just going to have to do it, because we don't want to half-ass it in any way.
No, imagine. Imagine if we just phoned it in for the final chapter. We're like, hey guys, well, guess what? And I won't say anything, because I was just about to spoil the entire
series. Oh my God, can you imagine?
Imagine if you got this far spoiler-free and then I just spoiled the ending for you.
Wow. I think we'd get blacklisted.
I think so. Disowned.
Yeah.
Another cute date to add to your schedule, if you are a patron, and if you are not a patron, now is a great time to join, because we are having a slightly belated spooky movie watch along. We love to try and do a little watch along with our patrons. We try to do it for Halloween, but we are late.
Yes, we are late.
So we are all going to get together and watch a spooky movie on the 19th of November at 8 p.m.
Yes.
UK time.
Yes.
So we'll just get in the Discord. We press play at the same time. It's going to be super cute. We have not yet chosen a film. We'll announce what film we've chosen.
Yes. I think soon. At the minute, I don't know if the polls ended or not, but the new Haunted Mansion was winning.
Nice.
So we'll see. But yes, come along to that. It's going to be so much fun. And in the new year as well, probably after we've finished podding for this book, we're going to run some watch-alongs, well, a watch-along of season 3, because we haven't done that, and we did seasons 1 and 2, and we really enjoyed doing it. So we're going to do that in the new year. So yeah, definitely a good time to join Patreon. It also obviously helps us out, as does buying our merch.
Yeah, merch.
Yes. So obviously holiday season is approaching. You guys aren't new here. You know the system. You know what's happening. We collect our t-shirt orders throughout the month, and then we place the orders at the end of the month, and then we ship them in the couple of weeks following. Because of the holidays, we want to make sure that you all have time to receive t-shirts. So I cut off this month for ordering t-shirts will be on the 20th of November rather than the last day of the month. So if you are wanting to buy like holiday gifts for anyone or to like treat yourself, do that before the 20th.
Yes, because then we will be able to get them printed and shipped out to you by that first week of December, because I don't trust Christmas posting dates.
No.
We all know that it becomes the most chaotic time of the year for the mail system.
Yes.
And things are more likely to get lost the later you leave it. So
for sure.
Yes.
For sure. Yeah. So that's everything. Bye. No, kidding.
Done. No need to do the chapter. No need to do the podcast.
But yeah, I don't think we have much else to add here, right?
No. No.
Do you have any markets to tell people about?
I do. Yeah. Oh my gosh. I hadn't even thought about that. Should you be in the Leeds vicinity at the beginning of December, on Sunday the 3rd of December, I will be vending at the Krampus-themed market, which is taking place at Key Club in Leeds from 12 till 4 on Sunday the 3rd of December. And Faye will be helping me.
Yes.
And last time we did that market, a couple of people that listened to the podcast stopped by to say hi, and it was adorable.
Yes. It was. And, well, we said to the people that we saw there that we usually bring stickers to give to people who come and say hello and say that they like the podcast. We will try our very best to remember to do that again. So yeah, please come and say hi, buy some of Rachel's stuff. The market's really cool anyway. So if you're into that like kind of like alternative like craft stuff, I always spend way too much money when I help Rachel these things. So it's worth coming along anyway. Just have a look.
It's the perfect market to buy the goths in your life a Christmas present.
Yes.
I will say that. And then the following Sunday, I will be at the Satanic Flea Market in London, which it takes place in a building called Electroworks in Angel. It's like a 5-minute walk from the tube station. That is 12 till 6. And I've only got a tiny little half a table. It's going to be mega busy. Recommend getting there early. Mm-hmm. If you are able to come, it's mega busy. It'll be really, really fun. And I will be on the top floor of that building, and it's going to be intense.
Yes. It's always so busy, but definitely go, because that's also a great place to buy like Christmas presents and just see, because it's really good. I won't be there because you don't catch me in London that much these days, but I'll be sending my thoughts and prayers and love.
Yes. And it is also a really good place. I consistently see at least 2 adventure cats at the Satanic Flea Market, and lots of really good dogs. Like great goths with great dogs.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, definitely. So yeah, come along to those and you'll see Rach, and you might see me if you come to Leeds.
Yeah. Yes. Faye, speaking of great dogs at their things, what would your demon be this week?
Hello. So
not hey Faye, speaking of great dogs.
I will take that compliment.
It was only meant as one.
Thank you. So my demon this week, so it was my birthday, it was Halloween, it was the end of spooky season, although we know that spooky season never truly ends. Spooky vibes. I was like, what the fuck will my demon be? And then I was doing my notes downstairs last night, and I looked up and I saw Metro Station Cat. And my demon this week is Metro Station Cat.
Oh my God. Yes. Which one? Faye has 2. So
I feel like we should explain what Metro Station Cat is.
There is Metro Station Cat lore that we have to drop for you guys now.
It was last year.
Yes. There was a somewhat viral TikTok of somebody found a little plush cat in a little purple wizard's hat and cape in Morrison's.
Yes.
In Morrison's at Halloween. And when you press his little foot, he does a wiggly dance and he sings shake it.
Yeah, it does. For too long.
For so long. Mm-hmm. Metro Station Cat has lived as a beloved addition to your spooky collection of fun Halloween things for a full year. However, this year, when you press his little paw, he sings the song very well, but he's lost his shake. He's lost his wiggle.
He can't shake it anymore.
He can't, much like us, he can't shake it like he used to.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And then Faye found a brand new, miraculous new Metro Station cat. Mm-hmm. So now she has two of this exact same dancing cat, one of which dances way too enthusiastically compared to the other.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. I have two. And the reason I got the second one is because I saw him on the shelf and he was by himself in Morrison's and it was the last one. And I was like, I have to have it. Also, before anyone says anything, yes, I have tried changing the batteries in old Metro Station Cat. He is just, he's done. He's done his time. His mission is complete. He's passed the baton.
To the brand new perky Metro Station
Cat. I will get a video of both of them. And I'll put them on social media. I don't know. Do I press them both at the same time? I think that's probably the best idea. Press them both at the same time. You can see the difference in them.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. You have to. I don't care how many times you have to listen to the song to get the presses at the right time. You have to do it.
Yeah.
And this is your reminder as listeners to please tweet at us or comment on one of our Instagram posts to remind us to do this if you have not done this.
Oh, please. Because you need to see it. It's so fun.
Yes.
It is so fun. So what would your demon be this week?
I was thinking about this and I am cold and it is always raining and currently living with a lovely dog who needs to be taken out many times a day in order to deplete his supply of excess beans because he's so full of beans. Mm-hmm. So I've just been walking in the rain a lot. And being cold and being wet. And all I want is a thick layer of blubber and a waterproof coat. So I would like to be a seal.
Oh, my God. Yes.
I would like for my demon to be a little seal. Not only that, I've had a lot of videos online recently of seals, like, flopping along on their tummies and doing the little bounce. And it makes me really happy. And everyone needs a cheer up season. Mm-hmm. It's tis sad season as the clocks have changed and it's gone dark. And I think witnessing a seal, like, flopping along on his little tummy next to us while I'm trying to walk the dog in the rain would just make me really happy.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
Hell yeah. And the seal would probably really like those walks as well. You'd have to take him to, like, a little stream or so, a river so he can have a splash time
with the dog. It would be adorable. There's some good streams. We've had a lot of flooding in the local area recently as well, so I think a seal would thrive in that.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. Oh, that's very cute. I do love seals. They're so I was going to say, they're so stupid, but they're not. They're very intelligent. They just look stupid. And I enjoy
they
that.
They look goofy.
Yeah, they do. They do. I enjoy that.
Like, I think like a classic harbour seal.
Yeah.
But like a cute little baby one.
Yeah. Like the ones that hang out on, is it Pier 39 in San Fran on that big thing? I don't think we saw any though, did we? Because there weren't any there when we went.
We didn't. It wasn't seal season.
No. But they all just like lay on top of each other. They all want to get on that certain bit of like wood so much that they all just pile on top of each other and lay on it.
So cute. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cuddle puddle of seals.
Yeah.
That's what I would like.
That sounds
even
good.
Even if it smells of fish, I don't care.
Yeah. That's fine. That's fine.
Oh, should we get into a chapter?
I think we should. Oh, I think we should. Last chapter, Mary finally figured out why dust is flowing out of the worlds and watched her beloved tree fall down.
She watched as Father Gomez, ew, showed up on one of those bastard birds and broke into her house. Rude.
In this chapter, Lyra and Will go off to explore Malefa World in search of their demons. A sort of hide-and-seek situation ensues.
Father Gomez, ew, stalks the children like the total creep that he is. But little does he know that our pal Balthamos was stalking him. Balthamos takes down Gomez and then disintegrates. R.I.P. Balthamos.
Lyra and Will finally acknowledge their feelings for each other and, oh my God, they kiss. And it saves the world.
It does.
It does. Oh my God. What a big chapter.
What a big chapter.
I really wasn't expecting it when I, like, first went into it and like read it through the first time before making my notes, because I guess they kind of pack a lot into the end of it, don't they? So yeah. I was just expecting it to be like a nice Will and Lyra chapter without any massive revelations. But yeah, here we are.
I completely forgot it was the kiss, this chapter. I thought they might find their demon.
Yes, because we're still without Pan and I miss him. We haven't seen him in so long.
So many chapters since we lost Pan.
Mm-hmm.
So upsetting.
Yeah.
How long ago was the bloody horrible time on the pier? Oh, it's the harpies. The harpies is the heartbreak chapter.
Okay.
So we lose Pan in chapter 21. So
and we're on chapter 35.
It's been more than 10 chapters.
Oh my God.
Since we've had no Pan.
Like nearly 15 chapters.
Mm-hmm.
Fucking hell.
Rude. That's the whole of the Subtle Knife that we've not had Pan for.
Jesus Christ. I miss him. Okay. Would you like to guess what the little picture is today?
I'm assuming that Phil has not drawn a pair of teenagers smooching, because that would be weird.
It has not. It has not.
Okay. Is it the beetle, like being held in some hands? No.
Have another guess. You are closer with Lyra and Will kissing.
Is it the bit of fruit that she tries to feed Will? Is it their marzipan
moment? It's a little, I guess, like, they look like berries almost. Can you see?
Oh, right. Yeah. Little sweet treats.
Yes. Tell me about the quote, because I struggled with this one, to be fair.
Fair. It makes sense once I give you context. So I'm very happy to come and deliver some context
to you. Yes, please.
The quote is, "The birthday of my life is come, my love is come to me." This is from a poem called A Birthday. And it is by Christina Rossetti.
We haven't had her before. She's new.
We haven't. And we love when Phil quotes a female poet, because he doesn't do it very often. I think the only other person we've had is Emily Dickinson.
I think so. Have we had any Virginia Woolf? Or was that just when we were talking about how they've all died?
You know what? I'm not sure. Write in and tell us.
It's few and far between if we have had more than two.
We've had a heck of a lot of William Blake, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And while we love him, it's nice. It's refreshing to get to research a new poet.
For sure.
So this is Christina Rossetti, who very much of the Victorian era. She was born in 1830 in London, and no surprise by the surname, she has Italian parents.
Mm-hmm.
Her first poems were published in 1842, which, if you do the maths, means that she was 12, and that is because she printed the poems herself on her grandfather's printing press, which is a very Lyra move.
Yes.
A very dramatic 12-year-old.
Love that. Entrepreneurship from old Christina.
Yes. And then she starts submitting...
Girl boss.
Yes. It's so cute. I'm just imagining this like 12-year-old trying to use giant printing press. I don't know. And then she starts submitting her poems to journals when she's around 20, but under a pseudonym. Mm-hmm. And one of the journals that she submits things to is run by her brothers. So that's cute. It's a very publishy, poetry family. Her best known work is called The Goblin Market and Other Poems. And that was published in 1862. So her like best piece of work was published when she was 32 years old, which is like... Ooh. Dream age, as we know, Faye.
Yeah, maybe I'm about to blast out my own like best poem of my life. Not that I've written much poetry other than that.
Maybe. The Goblin Market is an absolute vibe. Highly recommend, because also everybody is into like big, like strong goblin energy at the moment, aren't they?
Yes.
The youth, the kids, they love the goblin stuff. And so do I. And what's hilarious about it is, so she's quite a pious lady. She's quite a religious lady. But the way that this Goblin Market poem is written, a lot of people think that it's just like hella rude. Because I'm going to read a section of it to you that I was reading. And I thought, why do they think this is so rude? It's about like someone going and like spying on a goblin market. And that's cute.
Mm-hmm.
And there's like all of the different things that you can see at the Goblin Market. How cool is that? Mm-hmm. And then I was skimming the poem. It's a very long poem. I was skimming it, and one of the bits in it made me laugh out loud. Am I going to be able to find it? Oh, here we go. They're looking at the various fruits and veg on offer. Mm-hmm. Panniers and plates, look at our apples, russet and dun, bob at our cherries, bite at our peaches, citrons and dates, grapes for the asking, pears red with basking, out in the sun, plums on their twigs, pluck them and suck them. Pomegranates, figs.
Nice.
I love
very cute. Very I love whimsical, how you read that almost like a rap.
It's written like a rap. It's very short and choppy. But it was just pluck them and suck them. Mm. Just that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not surprised people are like, there's just a lot of descriptions of voluptuous fruits.
Yeah.
And how juicy things are. And it's like,
I understand.
Cool. But I love that for her. Mm-hmm. She basically that Goblin Market and other poems kind of establish her as a significant voice within Victorian poetry, which we love for her. Mm-hmm. In the 1880s, she tried to work as a governess, but she had Graves' disease and couldn't work. And so she is a classic sickly Victorian icon.
Yes. She shan't live to see spring.
Well, she actually lasts for quite a,
oh, good.
Lasts for quite a long time. She lives to about 70.
Oh, that's good.
Is it past 75? Don't know, but a fair way. I did not write down when she dies.
That's fine.
But yeah, she lives a fair amount of time carrying on publishing poetry right up until like 2 years before she died. She was still publishing poems. A lot of them are very Christian, so... and very much about her faith. So I can see as well why Phil has potentially pulled her as a poet in terms of like he quite likes to pick poetry that is very entangled in that in order to subvert it in some ways.
Yeah.
So this specific poem, A Birthday, is nice and short and I will just read it. My heart is singing like a bird whose nest is in a watered shoot. My heart is like an apple tree whose boughs are bent with thickest fruit. My heart is like a rainbow shell that paddles on a halcyon sea. My heart is gladder than all these because my love has come to me. Raise me a dais of silken down, hang it with vair and purple dyes. Carve it in doves and pomegranates and peacocks with 100 eyes. Work it in gold and silver grapes, in leaves and silver fleur-de-lis, because the birthday of my life is come, my love is come to me.
Okay.
So it's just about how bloody nice it is to be in love.
Yeah.
Or one interpretation is that it's about the joyful feeling of new love and how like that first feeling of first love feels like coming to life or being born for the first time, which makes a lot of sense in the context of this chapter, like the recognition and acknowledgement of that new love and how that literally brings the world back to life. It's very cool. Another way to read it is... as a bit of an ode to God, of like very like born again in God's love kind of thing, which is like, I'm less bothered about that. I think it's cuter if you think about it as a romantic love.
Yeah.
Or in terms of being like, especially because it's called A Birthday, in like that feeling of like when your child is born, like you also feel like you've been born because this whole new version of love has come to you. So there's a multiple different readings of it, but I think it's really cute. That it's just generally about how it feels really lovely to have love. That's it.
It's a lovely little poem. And I also agree that I just want to read it in the context of Lyra and Will and not in any kind of religious context. But we know that Phil has probably added it in there for buff.
Yeah.
Okay. Shall we start this chapter for reals?
For realsies, let's do it. We've really been talking for a million hours.
That's always how it goes, right? Here we are. Lyra, she tells Mary that they want to go and look for their demons. And Mary is very reluctant because obviously we're coming off the back of the chapter where Mary saw Gomez looking into her house. She knows that he's still around somewhere and she doesn't want the kids to go away and potentially encounter him. But Lyra just like doesn't care, which I love. She's got this like thing in her brain. She's got all these new things to think about, like, you know, regarding Will and all that kind of area of her brain that she wants to explore and think about. So she's like, yeah. And I get it as well. It's like when you really want to do something and then somebody's like, oh, maybe you shouldn't do it because it's dangerous. You're like, one track mind, especially when you're a kid, like, no, but that's the thing that I want to do. And you could tell me anything right now and I'd still want to go and do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very, okay, cool. Yeah, but what about the thing that I want to do? And I'm just going to do it anyway. Don't worry, I'll look out for myself. It's fine.
Yeah.
I understand stranger danger. Bye.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, I mean, Mary agrees. It's not like she really has the authority to tell them no. And she doesn't try and use that either. She just kind of says that she doesn't think it's a great idea. Mm. But she tells them to be careful and to stay out of the trees. And she packs them some food and wraps it in like a cloth. And it's given in like cartoons when they put like a stick with like a cloth over their shoulder. They're running away from home with food in it. That's the vibe it gave me.
Would you like to know one of my best embarrassing stories upon that theme?
Yes, absolutely. Oh my God, did you do this?
When I was little.
I think you might have told me this before, but please, please tell me again.
I was upset and I wanted to run away from home. In a true dramatic, very drama kid fashion, I packed all of my important things, probably like a Tamagotchi and some Beanie Babies, in a bandana, like a red bandana with white print on it, tied it up, and I tied it to... Do you remember how Pizza Hut were too cheap to use helium for their balloons, so they were on little plastic sticks?
Oh my God, yes.
And I tied it to a Pizza Hut helium no helium stick thing, and strutted off down the road. I think I had a couple of Bourbon biscuits in there as well. I think I got as far as like the lamppost at the end of the road, and then I sat down and had a cry and came home.
Oh my God.
But it's very specifically the vivid memory of the Pizza Hut stick.
That's so funny. I really wish that somebody had been there to like take a photo of it, because like I know it defied the very important and dramatic you running away vibe, but oh my God, did your parents even realize?
Oh, they probably didn't notice at all. It's just being dramatic.
I love how, isn't it weird how when you're a kid, like the idea of like running away from home is kind of like a staple in a lot of kids' heads. Like that's just a thing that you can do and survive. Like, sure.
I think I just read way too much Jacqueline Wilson books.
Same.
That's probably the culprit. Yeah.
God, Jacqueline Wilson. She wrote some, I loved her when I was a kid, but I mean, I remember being very young reading about like a fucking kid that had been dumped in a dustbin and like...
Mm-hmm. Dustbin Baby, a classic. Dustbin.
Yeah, yeah. And April Showers. Is that when her mum... Does her mum die? I can't remember.
Ooh, I don't think I read that one.
Yeah.
I was obsessed with The Cat Mummy, which is about a girl who hides a dead cat in her wardrobe.
Yeah. There's a lot of...
And that's fine.
So much trauma. Even in like I guess like mainstream ones, for want of a better phrase, like Tracy Beaker, so traumatic. She's been through so much, old Tracy.
Yeah, very much so. I feel like we've had a Jacqueline Wilson before on the podcast, and I'm here for it. I'm here to do it again.
Yeah,
every time.
We have. Okay, so during this chapter, there is so much curiosity and question asking between Will and Lyra. It feels like they finally got the time to get to know each other on like the most basic level, because they've got to know each other throughout these books in the most dramatic fashion, and they know very intimate details about each other, like how they deal with a crisis, how they deal with a fight, how they deal with grief, all these things that, you know, even if you've been in a romantic relationship or a friendship with someone for years and years and years, you still might not know those things about those people that you love. They have so much like intimate knowledge of each other, but they don't have any real basic day-to-day knowledge of each other.
Yeah. Except for all the stuff about omelets.
Oh yeah, first met. Of course. The first thing that we get them talking about is home, because they wonder about Mary and they talk about Mary being sad. Lyra says maybe she misses home, maybe she's worried about her lab getting taken over. Maybe she's sad about the guy that marzipaned, you know, that vibe.
I'm confused as to why Lyra thinks that Mary is sad. I think she's just tired and, like, worried
but
and
again,
stressed.
Yeah, I mean, but also when you're a kid, you don't have a ton of emotional intelligence and you would maybe just read that as sad.
True.
Yeah. It's very easy to just say sad or happy, isn't it? But there's like a multitude of different emotions that you can have in between that.
Yeah. I think it's a vehicle for getting to be like, what are you thinking about going, are you going to come to my house?
Yeah.
Am I going to go to your house?
Yes.
What's going on? I want to go home, but like, I also want to see you, is what they're saying.
So how is that going to work? Yes. For sure. So what this made me realise is that Lyra doesn't really have a home.
Oh.
And it's so sad.
Yeah.
Because she's a bit like, well, John and college, I don't think they'd have me back now. I can't really live with the bears. I can't really live with the witches. Maybe I could go and live with Egyptians if they'd have me. And obviously they definitely would. You know, Mark Astor would be all over that.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
And then Will asks about Asriel's world. And then Lyra's just like, oh, it's going to fail.
Yeah. I kind of love how matter of fact she is about it. Of just being like, oh, yeah, well, that's just not going to work. That's going to fail. He probably just didn't think about it. And like, you didn't know that you can't. But also reinforces this. You can't live in a world that your demon is not from. You will not survive or thrive.
Yeah.
And the way that she's so matter of fact about it, but it's kind of, yeah, just like, oh, all that bravery, that's all wasted, all for nothing. He couldn't have known. And she is talking very much about Asriel as if this is a thing that he's going to carry on and do, because she doesn't know that he is currently falling into an abyss with his ex-lover.
Yeah. Yeah.
And their new friend.
And their new pal that's going to...
Third wheel for eternity.
Eternal third wheel. I can't remember if we ever named our sitcom about this, but yeah.
Oh, I don't know. Surely it's just called like Fallen For You.
Oh my God. Love it. Love it. So I think this is a little bit of a like clever insertion from Phil here, because for me, when I read this, it kind of like, I guess, not finally hit home, but it's a good way of like really defining the fact that Asriel did this whole thing and it failed, and that's not the important part of this story. So like, people that are reading it for the first time might be wondering, well, what's going to happen with, like, you know, Asriel's like Republic of Heaven or whatever he called it. And it's like, no, that actually failed. Like, the thing that Asriel wanted to do most, it didn't happen,
and it was also never gonna succeed.
Yeah.
So they carry on climbing, and they kind of, I feel like this is just a lot of like them walking between places, and they're just bringing up some little conversations and like testing the water on some of this like slightly more casual emotional intimacy that they're having here, because they both kind of just have this moment where they acknowledge that they picked each other's demons up, and it's a little bit embarrassing, and like Lyra can see in Will's face that he also knew it was taboo, but like, a little bit embarrassing, a little bit thrilling at the same time. They're all both like half frightened, half excited. And I just think that's really cute. And the way that they're like broaching these little subjects and then carrying on walking.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing about that paragraph in particular about picking up the demons is the line, it was forbidden not only by politeness, but by something deeper than that, something like shame. And I think like, here we are again in that space where anything to do with, I'm always like a bit hesitant to say the word like sexuality or sex, because obviously they're children, but like in their like awakening of these things within them, even if they're not aware that that's what it is at the time, like their puberty, they're like realizing that these are options that they have in the future, realizing that they have romantic feelings. It's again rooted in shame. And I think that picking up someone's demon gives me that same vibe of being shameful for those reasons, if that makes sense.
It's crossing like a social boundary and a social taboo that possibly doesn't exist when you are that bit older, or when it's with an intimate romantic partner that's established. But like, you still, as a society, we don't talk about it. We don't talk about what happens in the bedroom. Ooh, especially not in Lyra's world, that's for sure.
Oh, God, yeah.
Especially not that massively religiously repressed.
Oh, God.
Like, lovely bit of Catholic shame for all of them.
Yeah, yeah. I enjoy that they feel shy with each other, and Will's just not put off by being shy, which is such an interesting way to look at being shy, because it seems like that would be the opposite of being shy, but it's not. He's just like, I guess he's used to being shy, bless him.
Yeah, he's like, oh, I'm shy. Oh, we're both shy. Carry on. Let's have a little demon corner. We've not had like a little demon download for ages.
We haven't.
And we reiterate a bit about, when do our demons settle? And what does it say about us as a person? And we get, so Lyra's kind of, I guess it's only just occurred to her. She's like, about, I suppose, our age or a bit older, maybe more sometimes. And I just think that's what is kind of just occurring to her. She's like, oh gosh, it is soon, isn't it?
Yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah.
And people don't necessarily have any idea of what their demon might settle as when they're young. But as you grow up, you start thinking about it. And we have this little reiteration. Phil loves to point out that servants' demons are dogs.
Yes. Yeah.
And we get it again. I don't know what this says about the way that he thinks about dogs or people that work in the service industry.
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? Because this is the first time we've had it before where Phil has said people that are servants have dog demons. But then Lyra explains why she thinks that servants have dog demons. It's very...
It feels demonist.
It feels very negative, doesn't it? Like the way that she words it in terms of, if your demon's a dog, that means you like doing what you're told and knowing who's boss and following orders and pleasing people who are in charge. Basically, you're just a little sub.
Sure. Yeah. That's, you know what? That's actually a kinder way to look at it than just being like, yeah, you're a follower, you're a people pleaser. You're, which is obviously, it's not all bad traits, but it's weird to just be like, yeah, and servants have dog demons because they like being told what to do. It's like, I think it's a Lyra's warped understanding
for sure
of what servants, what working class people are.
Yeah.
Basically. Yeah. Like, it's fully just Lyra doesn't understand what working class is because she grew up being treated as this like ward of an academic institution by like posh white out of touch men.
For sure. So. And also the thing is with a dog as well is that it's a dog is a very useful animal. And it's one of those things where working class people might need that more, might need that extra hand more than somebody that was born into like fucking riches or whatever and has a fucking snow leopard or a golden monkey, you know what I mean? Like, there's a lot more that a dog can do than these other animals.
We've had this conversation as well before about how like we think, is it, can your demon only turn into animals you know about and are educated about? Like if you are like working class, you probably don't have the same level of education as like Lyra, who keeps getting told like, oh, this is what a cool leopard looks like. She's interacting with people with more interesting demons on a day-to-day basis. And we get a lot of descriptions of like the kids and the Egyptians demons and a lot of people that are more like working class vibes. They tend to have demons that are just a bit more accessible, usually more like British wildlife animals.
Yes.
And yeah, usually just more relatable animals than the weird aristocracy who have like golden monkeys and snow leopards and stuff. Like they feel like highfalutin animals.
Yeah, for sure. 100%. So I really like what Will says here. It does make me feel a bit sad. But Lyra asks him, how do people in your world know what they're like, as in their demons? And he says, I don't know. I don't know much about my world. All I know is keeping secret and quiet and hidden. So I don't know much about grown-ups and friends, all of us. I think it'd be difficult having a demon because everybody would know so much about you just by looking. I like to keep secret and stay out of sight. And I think that's one of the most like sadly profound things Will has ever said, in the sense of how you can live in a world and not know about that world at all.
Oh, Will.
I know.
He's got friends now.
Yeah.
He's got Mary. He's got a grown-up that he can talk to, and that's lovely. But also interesting that he said, I don't know what it's like to have friends or lovers.
Or lovers.
And it's got its own little, it's kind of...
It's a little sentence.
It's in the paragraph, it's in its own little sentence. It's there, it's highlighted.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, Will.
Yeah. Also, I do think I do agree with him to a certain extent of, I don't know how I'd feel about having my demon on show all the time and whether my demon would be more of a hidden thing. Because it's a very, like, intimate thing, isn't it? To, like, have part of yourself that people can read into immediately without even having a conversation with you, like, on display all the time.
Yeah. And like, sometimes you just don't wish to be perceived.
Exactly.
And if you had like a parrot demon or something, because on the days when you did have energy, you were a big old extrovert.
Yeah.
What about the days when you don't? Like, where does the parrot go? It's got to be with you. So.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So we go off on this like kind of big hide and seek thing with the demons, like, the demons are, they notice there's something in the grass. We get to it in a little bit, but I mean, we'll just give the overview so we don't have to keep going back to that. But this whole area of the chapter is them kind of playing hide and seek from the demons.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. Are they like, is their vibe that they want the demons to show themselves and they don't want to, like, be like, we can see you, come out, kind of thing? Are they, like, scared that they'd then run away again?
I think it's this thing of, like, they are sort of unsure of how best to, like, respect their space and respect their wishes.
Mm.
'Cause they get the vibe that the demons are actively hiding from them.
Yeah.
There's this little moment where they mention that they can see them out of the peripheral, their like peripheral vision, and they mention this whole like Keats unfocusing thing that Lyra...
Yeah, negative capability.
The poet Keats said it first, Dr. Malone knows, it's how I read the alethiometer and it's how you use the knife, isn't it? It's negative capability. And that is kind of how they're like looking mm-hmm. for the demons. They're like looking and not looking. And I kind of love that that's pulled into how they're finding their demons, and that they're like connecting on this level that's like not fully actively conscious. And that they're having this kind of weird hide and seek, but also it's in this like liminal brain space that's all happening at the same time.
But
I think it's very much they're like, why would they be hiding from us if they wanted to be found yet? And I where do you stand on this in terms of the demons? They're following the demons, that sometimes the demons are following them, but they're going from the big wide open space that feels a bit exposed into like cozier and cozier and more picturesque, perfect spot for a little picnic and a smooch. Do we think the demons have led them to the perfect makeout spot? Like, do they know? Because the demons have a connection, don't they? They have to.
I didn't even think about that. I think yes.
Do you think? Do we think Pan and Will Steven have like led them to the best makeout spot? Because I kind of like that, as opposed to them just being not ready to talk and hiding still.
I like that, but also they could have also done it on a subconscious level. The demons could have done that subconsciously.
Yeah.
But they could also have very much made that decision together, being like, we're going to lead them into this little cozy makeout spot. But that's very cute. I like that.
Yeah, or like, we're not ready to see them yet, but also we can see that something is happening there and we need to give it space. But like, we also need to be present because we're that demon. So we need to like, it's like chaperoning, but not chaperoning kind of thing a little bit, I feel like.
So the place where they first think they see them is at Mary's tree, and they call it a ruined palace, which was really sad. And the way it's described is just really sad. I think it how big that the way that it's described on like how big that tree is knocked down, I think it would scare me if I saw it. Do you know, because I have that weird thing about big things.
Yeah. Like, no, I can see that. It's really hard to like think about the scale.
So her hand was warm and it was grabbing his arm. He's very aware of it. We get a lot of that this chapter. And then they agree to walk away to see if the demons will follow them. And it becomes that game that we just talked about. Then we move on to a conversation about Will going home. And Lyra asks Will if he'll go home. He says he has to because of his mum again. Always thinking about his mum.
Oh, bless him. Yeah.
And we see some progression here because Lyra says, what about those men that are after you? And he's like, we've been through much worse than that. I can. And he was so scared of that in like the subtle knife and like a little bit of the amber spyglass. Mm-hmm. So it's nice to see that progression from him. And then we get like these sad bits where Lyra's like, but I wanted to show you Jordan College. I wanted to show you the Fens. And he's like, yeah, I want to go back to Chittagatse. It was such a beautiful place. And
I love that they have their special place that's just for them.
Yeah, me too.
There's a weird little, not weird, there's like an interesting like rumination on the idea of like what's fair. And it just shows Will's really strong sense of justice and really strong like emotional maturity for a child of his age, because you think of like Lyra being like, that's not fair, because she's grown up without any levels of like responsibility as a child. I mean, obviously she's had the weight of the world on her shoulders for the last however many months, but up until that point, very responsibility free. Lyra says, but it's not fair on you that you have to do that. He says, no, but it's a different sort of not fair. It's like an earthquake or a rainstorm. It might not be fair, but no one's to blame. But if I just leave my mother with an old lady who isn't very well herself, then that's a different kind of not fair. That would be wrong. I've just got to go home. But probably it's going to be difficult to go back to where we were. Probably the secret's out now. I don't suppose Mrs. Cooper will have been able to look after her. not if my mother's in one of those times when she gets frightened of things. So she's probably had to get help. And when I go back, I might get put into some kind of institution. Oh, well.
The overthinking of that makes me like, I'm like, I relate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The fact that he just went from like, there's a different kind of unfair to like, oh my God, what's going to have happened to my mum? I've left her with this old lady. Like, I can't, I'm going to get put into foster care. I don't know what's happening. Yeah. Like,
I love that analogy of the thing being not fair. I think it's a really good explanation of, sometimes things aren't fair because there's there's a force you can't control at work or, but sometimes things aren't fair because you've done a shitty thing. Do you know what I mean? Or someone's done a shitty thing to you.
Some unfair things, are the direct result of somebody treating you unfairly. And some things are just unfair because bad situations or difficult situations just happen.
Yes.
Life is unfair.
Truly. Isn't it just?
Yes.
So he wants his own house to look after his mom, which is very sweet. Very, very sweet. And then Lyra just comes out of nowhere. Do you think you'll get married?
I don't know if I'd get married, but would you get married? I feel like if I were to marry someone, it might be to someone who like wasn't from my world. I don't know how you feel about it.
It could only be someone that understands what I've been through, and that wouldn't be anyone from my world.
No, and like it would have to be someone that's also like traveled to the land of the dead. And understands what that's like.
Yeah,
maybe someone who had a demon that was separated from them in the land of the. And maybe it would have to be someone that understands all that stuff. Like has been through the exact same experience as me. You know?
Yeah.
No.
Agreed. Totally agreed. Agreed.
It's so cute.
It's very cute. It is very cute. And at this bit, I just want to pop a pin in this bit. They walked on slowly, wandering towards the horizon. They had all the time in the world. All the time the world had. Interesting. Yes.
Yeah.
Pop a pin. And then Lyra asks if Will's going to keep the knife so that he can visit her. And he says, of course, I certainly wouldn't give it to anyone else, ever. I mean, it's like, it's sweet, but it also is like, why the fuck would he ever give it to anyone else?
Right. I mean, but also the whole point of the knife, right, is that it's not necessarily given willingly. You have to fight it.
Oh, yeah, and, exactly. Like,
you have to get your fingers chopped off in a fight to bear it, don't you?
Yeah, so, true.
Yeah. If he is going to give it to someone else, it's not going to be willingly.
No, that is true. So, then we play this, like, big demon-searching game where they're, like, looking under rocks and, like, Lyra makes a big show about hurting an ant. And all these kind of things where, like, the demons are nearby listening.
And, like, making it really disgusting things that they could be like, oh, maybe they're slugs. Maybe maybe they're under this gross bit of wood being, like, beetles. Like, it's cute.
And then they have, like, this bit of, I guess, reassurance between each other. Lyra asks, should we have left them? And Will's like, we didn't have a choice. Like, we needed to, Lyra, you needed to go and apologise to Roger. And she's like, you needed to go and see your dad. And then obviously the bigger thing of these two things is that they needed to go and... Which is cute that they still haven't realised that that's the biggest thing that they did.
Yeah.
That they had to go and save the people from the land of the dead. That's still kind of like secondary in a way to them. Yeah.
That feels like a high enough stake as well. Like, RIP Roger, pour one out for Roger. But he never felt like a high enough stake lose Pan over.
Yeah.
And the fact that her like excuse of needing to say sorry to Roger was like so big felt so weird, but it's obviously because she had to do something bigger, which was to let all the ghosts free, and she just didn't know that. Yeah, it's still funny that that's the first thing she says, like, well, I needed to say sorry to Roger. It's like, did you?
Yeah. But then she does say like, well, hopefully Pan will be okay with it because now we'll be together when we die. Or she says, when I die, we'll be together. As the day progresses, they start to look for some shade because it's getting hot. And they head down into a valley and find a spring. And they talk about water flowing for a little bit and how it works.
Yeah, Lyra doesn't understand streams, I guess.
Yeah.
And Will does. Cute. Yeah.
There's like so much tension to them this chapter, which I really enjoy the build of. Like they're very awkwardly formal with each other at some points. And I think that's really astute of Phil to notice, I guess, of like when you, no matter how well you know someone, if your relationship to them like changes, everything becomes awkward and formal for a little bit until you like delve into like the new realms of what that relationship might look like on the other side of all this like awkwardness and formality.
Yeah.
So I do like that the like dynamic is a little bit different between them this chapter. And then my next note is, oh, and here comes Gomez to fucking ruin it yet again.
Honestly, I hate him so much. It's so creepy. And I will say I have an objection to how his segments are placed within the chapter.
Okay.
Like I wish that they just did it all in one big segment and we didn't jump cut between him and the kids, because it means that at the end of the chapter, you almost could read it as the thing that brought Dust back was Balthamos killing him. Like, because it just jumps straight over to like, and that's the thing that's changed, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. So he's been following them. And then that made me think, obviously, we had a discussion last chapter about whether he was after Lyra or Mary. So I guess he is after Lyra.
And very much not after Will, because he makes a weird-ass moralization comment about him. He doesn't want to hurt the boy because he's an innocent. But the girl, she's full of evil.
The misogyny.
She's full of sin. And aren't they just walking down the path to sin together? Rude.
The misogyny of that is very, well, obviously it's very Adam and Eve, isn't it? But very, very misogynistic, very just horrific, isn't it? Just fucking horrific.
It's the one thing he didn't want to do was hurt the boy. He had a horror of harming an innocent person. And then we cut down to Father Gomez found himself praising God for his mission because it was clearer than ever that the boy and the girl were walking into mortal sin. It's like, couldn't possibly hurt the boy, but there they walk off together into this mortal sin that you're so scared of. Yeah. So
it's interesting. We get the mention of flesh again in that paragraph.
The fact that his beetle is following the smell of the flesh of those literal children.
I know.
It's so creepy.
I know.
He's such a creep.
Yeah, it's all like, so like that paragraph that you mentioned, like flesh, bodies, mortal sin, it all feels very like sensual, like very like almost sexual, like we've talked about it. And again, it's kind of hard to like figure out how we want to talk about it because you don't want to say sexual because they're children, but this like awakening of something in them.
No, but the point is that he wants to say that because he's being creepy about it, and that's what makes him a creepy character.
Yeah, for sure. But then also this is a thing of that, like, it's obvious to us, it's also obvious to other people, even if it is Gomez.
Yeah, I think it's that Gomez is seeing it and it's making him flip out because he's like, oh my god, it's like they're going to be immediately doing incredibly adult stuff, which is how we all know that's not how that works.
Yeah.
They're children. We see it and we go, oh, cute, puppy love. Like, it's adorable. They're kids. They're feeling these feelings for the first time. And it's, whilst it is the entire theme of this book is innocence and a loss of innocence, it's in a way to be celebrated and embraced and just understood in a neutral fashion, which is something that he does not have the ability to do. He can only see it and panic and froth at the mouth over how horrifying it is.
True. Very true. So would you like me to tell you about this next paragraph, because there is a difference in the UK edition to the US edition.
Yes.
Okay, so I'll read you what it says in the UK edition, and then I'll read you what it says in the US edition. So Father Gomez found himself praising God for his mission because it was clearer than ever that the boy and the girl were walking into mortal sin. And there it was, the dark blonde movement that was the girl's hair. He moved a little closer and took out the rifle. There was a telescopic sight, low-powered but beautifully made, so that looking through it was to feel your vision clarified as well as enlarged. Yes, there she was, and she paused and looked back so that he saw the expression on her face. And he could not understand how anyone so steeped in evil could look so radiant with hope and happiness. His bewilderment at that made him hesitate, and then the moment was gone, and both children had walked in among the trees and out of sight. Well, they wouldn't go far. He followed them down the stream, moving at a crouch, holding the rifle in one hand, balancing with the other. He was so close to success. And then in the US edition, Father Gomez found himself praising God for his mission because it was clearer than ever that the boy and the girl were walking into mortal sin. He watched them go in among the trees. They hadn't looked back once since coming over the top of the ridge, but he still kept low, moving down the stream at a crouch, holding the rifle in one hand, balancing with the other. He was so close to success.
Ooh, that's interesting.
So they removed the entire paragraph about how Lyra looked. So everything that describes her, like, so like her dark blonde hair, her radiant and hopeful and happy expression, the fact that she distracted him from what he was doing. So I wonder whether, like, I mean, I don't read it like this, but I wonder whether it's similar to what they removed in Marzipan, where they thought that it was just a bit too, I don't know.
Yeah. Because it also removes the bit about the specifics of looking through the sight of the rifle and it feels your vision. And I was like, is it the specifics of how guns work? And they're like, well, not for a children's book. But then, like, they're not as obsessed with gun.
Yeah. A bear's jaw off.
But I was going to say no, because it's America and they're actually more pro-gun than they are anything else. So, yeah, that is weird.
I think it's probably to do with the descriptions of Lyra, which is just... But, like, they're making it more weird by taking it out.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I read that and I just thought, oh, he's feeling conflict and look at Lyra being so happy and hopeful and full of joy. And like, yes, I would be questioning my weird godly mission if the person that I'd been told was like evil as hell was just looking like really cute and happy.
Yeah.
Like that's all I would ever read it as. But what a weird thing to have changed.
Yep. So then we get this like thing about Gomez, again, as we just read, being so close to success, he found himself speculating on what he would do afterwards and whether he would please the kingdom of heaven more by going back to Geneva or staying to evangelize this world. The first thing to do here, this is so fucking ridiculous.
I know.
The first thing to do here would be to convince the four-legged creatures who seem to have the rudiments of reason that their habitat of riding on wheels was abominable and satanic and contrary to the will of God. Break them of that and salvation would follow. Like, I understand, because obviously it's about removing their autonomy so that they can't be who they can't do what they want.
And their connection to dust, it's the same as like removing a demon.
But I'm just like, it just reads so stupidly, doesn't it? Like, take the wheels are satanic, actually.
Just as an outsider observing this, wheels equal Satan.
Mm-hmm.
Get rid. Done.
I mean, it does. It does. I know that not all biker gangs are satanic, but it does kind of like go into our theory about the Malefa being a biker gang.
Yes, it does.
But yeah, so stupid. Like, just so pathetic, isn't it? That's the word. We've called Gomez pathetic before, but I think just pathetic. Leave the Malefa alone.
Truly, leave our wheels alone.
Yeah. He bends down to pick up his gun and something has grabbed his demon.
It's Balthamos.
Yeah. Balthamos. He's back. Yes. We haven't seen him in fucking ages.
We didn't know if he was alive or dead till this very moment.
Yeah.
And then we're back with Will and Lyra. This is the cut that I didn't need. I want to put this bit. I want to switch over this bit with the next Gomez bit so we get all the Gomez stuff done and dusted in one section. But
fair. Makes sense.
But yes, Will and Lyra, carrying on, find a lovely little clearing, open up their little runaway child hamper full of food, take off their shoes and socks so they can do a bit of piggy dipping in the stream.
Piggy dipping.
And just have a lovely little chill. And there's a little mention here where Will says that he's hungry. And Lyra's like, me too. And then she notes that she's feeling something a bit more than hungry.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't know what that is. She doesn't understand it. But it's just because she's excited because she's going to smooch him.
Yes. Oh, God. It's so like, I love the descriptions of them like being really clumsy, them like not being able to taste the food and all that kind of stuff. Because they're just so like in this moment. It's so dramatic. I love it.
It's so dramatic. But at the same time, this little moment with the fruit.
Mm-hmm.
My note for this is, oh my God, she marzipanned him.
Yes.
Right after having heard that story. But like, she's literally just heard Mary tell the marzipan story. And nothing is more, and it's so perfect because it is so dramatic teen of her to be like, well, I just heard this really romantic story where somebody fed somebody. And so that's what I associate with being romantic. So now I'm going to feed Will. And like, Will is also such a cheesy little teenager that he sees what she's doing. And he's like, yeah, I'm into that. And like, the whole thing makes me cringe the house down.
But it's so cute. But it's so cute.
And it's so accurate for how like dramatic in love for the first time teenagers are. Like, you're gonna say and do some incredibly cheesy cliche stuff, and that's fine.
Yeah, exactly. So my question to you is, did Mary pack that fruit on purpose for this moment?
Because she thought it was the equivalent of a baby bell.
No, because we get there's like little descriptions of this fruit when Mary's packing it about it being very sweet, and like the words used like make me think that they lend themselves to this moment. And I'm wondering whether she had an inkling that something like this might happen after telling the story.
I think the dust might have made it happen more than Mary, because I would feel very creepy as a grown-up being like, I told the kids this story about how I thought it was sexy when someone fed me marzipan, so I'm going to give them a bunch of sweets.
But also, was it that she thought it was sexy, or was it that she just felt the like nice feelings? Is what I took it as being.
I know. I just think that's funny.
Yeah. It is. And it's like such a lovely moment because of what you said about like, oh, I heard this story literally yesterday, so I'm going to reenact it immediately.
It's so cute. It's cringe. So cute.
And the fact that they're like both confused, and she like puts the fruit to his lips, he obviously eats it, but then she leaves her hand there, and then he like grabs her hand, so I can just imagine their hands just in the air, like holding each other's hand in the air. And I love the description of like two moths clumsily bumping together with no more weight than that. Their lips touched, then before they knew how it happened, they were clinging together, blindly pressing their faces towards each other. And I love the like how that description, even though it doesn't say it outright, it shows their innocence.
Yeah.
Their like lack of experience in this area of life. The fact that first they like bumped together like moths and that was it. And then all of a sudden they were all over each other, but they didn't really know what to do. So their faces were just like pressed together.
Just the awkward, that awkward, perfect awkwardness of a first kiss. Just,
yeah.
So awkward, so cute, so clumsy. And like, and then they're kind of like talking to each other. And like Mary said, you know, straight away when you like someone, when you were asleep on the mountain before she took you away, I told Pan. And Lara's like, I heard, I was awake and I wanted to tell you the same. And now I know what I must have felt all the time. I love you.
Oh.
Ah, so cute. And then he's really excited because she said love. And they're like, ah, and then they're kissing, and it's just really cute. Yeah, that's it. It's just really, really cute.
It's so sweet.
And it's well written as just a sweet, just a couple of awkward little teens confessing their love for each other and then being incredibly awkward. Like, it's not, I just think it's well written as not being, considering how creepy Gomez is and how well the like creepiness of how you could view this as being so sinful, and it's not. It's written so relatably.
Yeah, oh, for sure.
I think is the word. Like, it's not poetic and lovely in a way that is like over romanticizing it. It's awkward. It's an awkward teenage kiss, and it's perfect because it is what it is.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And then again, like you said, this is just like such a really short, like little gone back to Lyra and Will, and now we're back with like Gomez and Balthamos again. It's a strange one. So yeah, we're back with them. Balthamos is very scared. He is aware that even though he's an angel, Gomez is stronger than him, although it's kind of obvious that Gomez doesn't think that for a while anyway. So all that Balthamos can think to do is like hold the demon who's like biting him and stinging him in his hand, which must be so fucking painful. To then just walk, just carry on walking. He's trying to get him away from the kids. And we have like Gomez like asking who he is. Like he, and then Balthamos slips and his foot goes in the water. And then Gomez can see his footprints.
Yeah. Gomez like grabs him and feels feathers and thinks, oh my God, an angel. And so he's a bit like, oh, what am I doing now? And then, yeah, and you can see Barthelmess's footprints. And then he, like, watches him enough that you can see his, like, imprints of his feet on the ground as he's moving. And, like...
And it's interesting, that bit as well, where, like, Gomez is kind of playing a part of being like, oh, please, please stop, let's talk, when actually what he's doing is, like, trying to gather more information about what is happening to try and get the upper hand.
Yeah. And that's the fact that Barthelmess is able to keep hold of the demon and keep him, like, that bit further away and still kind of maintain the upper hand and hold his ground.
Mm-hmm.
Gomez is like poised to strike, but Barthelmess is like, sit down.
Yeah.
Don't come any closer. And they have this little back and forth where Father Gomez is like, but you're an angel. And Barthelmess is like, well, I want to kill you. So, because you're trying to kill my friends.
Yeah, because Gomez is like, yeah, but we might be on the same side because you're an angel and I'm a like man of God. And Barthelmess is like, we are absolutely not fucking absolutely on the same side.
Yeah.
No way. No way.
What do I want? I want to kill you, but I haven't got the strength.
Yeah.
Fair.
Yeah.
And what I love that what makes Barthelmess cry out in like despair, being like, what the hell, is when Gomez is like, it's not too late to repent. Even angels are allowed to do that. Let me hear your confession. You think you're good enough to hear the confession of an actual angel?
Right.
What? That's right. Hilarious.
And then it also, I think not until you said it, I didn't read it in that way, but then him just being like, oh, Baroque. I can't, like, help me. I can't fucking take any more of this man's fucking bullshit. Like, it's like, oh.
Honestly, I feel like it's that. It's give me the strength to kill this guy before he keeps talking.
Yes.
It's literally give me strength, but it's just, oh, Baroque.
Yeah, for sure. Yes. For sure. So they have a fight.
I love that it's not a fight.
It's not really a fight, is it? Yeah, I guess it's not the right word.
So Gomez launches himself at Barthelmess, and in that same moment it knocks Barthelmess off balance, and he, in throwing out a hand to save himself, the insect demon gets free, and so Gomez feels like this surge of relief. He's free. He launches himself at Barthelmess, but because he's mid-launch, when the demon gets freed, he like passes through him, past him. He's stronger than he thinks, and Barthelmess just sticks his foot out and trips him,
fucking legs him up, doesn't he?
Yeah. I love that it's not a battle of wits. Mm-hmm. It's not
like an epic fight.
He doesn't deserve to go down fighting like how Yorick Bernison deserves to go down, you know? He deserves to be tripped by an angel who we very much love, but is a big old wet flannel. We love him, but he's a wet flannel.
Yeah.
He deserves to be tripped and drown in an inch of water. And that's exactly what happens. And I love it.
Because
he goes down,
perfect.
He hits his face into the water, and Barthelmess just kind of lightly puts his, like, stands on him, basically.
Yeah, and we know that move from Barthelmess must be, we know how weak Barthelmess is, we know how easily Gomez just like kind of went through him, so we know that touch on Gomez to hold him under the water can't be much at all.
Mm-mm. But it's everything that Barthelmess has.
Yeah, so it is. You know what, before we say bye to Barthelmess, I think we should just say, haha, fuck you, Gomez. This is exactly the death that you deserve.
Oh, for sure. He does not deserve any kind of martyrdom ending, which is, I think, what he wanted. He wanted to go down fighting if he was going to go down. No.
Yeah.
He had a, quite frankly, Schadenfreude-laden death. He just tripped over and fell on his face.
Yeah.
Great.
How embarrassing.
How embarrassing. So embarrassing to be you. Yeah. And I just, I love that it's so anticlimactic for him. It's perfect. I love that this little that Barthelmess was able to do is enough to redeem him, and that we get our final moment with Barthelmess where he shouts out to his love, his great love, and we are reminded that gay angels are the best angels.
Yeah. He says, Baroque, he said, oh, Baroque, my dear, I can do no more. Will and the girl are safe and everything will be well, but this is the end for me, though I truly died when you did, Baroque, my beloved. And a moment later, he was gone.
R.I.P.
R.I.P.
No. R.W.B. Rest with Baroque.
Yeah.
You deserve to be together.
Yeah.
Oh, sweet babies, dust floating in the wind together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, it's sad. Oh, it's fucking sad, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
And then we come back, not to Lyra and Will, but to Mary and Natal.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why I feel like it should have been flipped the other way around, because if we'd have had the lovely kiss and then we cut to Mary and Natal, seeing them come back over the hill, it fits together better in my head.
Yeah, I get that.
Gomez dying and then marrying Natal and being like, look, look, the dust is coming back. And it's like,
yeah,
that should have happened right after the lovely kiss.
Yeah. Yeah, I know what you mean. But Phil's got to break it up, right? He's got to like raise the tension somehow.
Yeah. We had to just fully get Gomez out of the picture.
Yeah.
I feel like by this point, you'd probably regretted writing him in.
Yes. It's like, what is
the
point?
We regret him writing him in.
Truly, what the fuck is the point? Like, oh, whatever. So yes, Atal alerts Mary that there's a change. She can sense it. So Mary looks through a spyglass and she can see that although the dust still is moving away, it's not flowing in that like a massive flood that it was before. Mm-hmm. And then they see Lyra and Will walking like over the hill holding hands, just like dawdling and being all cute.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very sweet.
And Mary kind of like, I feel like in a moment of like sort of respecting their privacy, like decides not to look through the spyglass at them to like confirm her suspicion, which is that they will be absolutely covered in dust.
Yeah.
Because they've kind of crossed that threshold into from innocence to discovery, I guess.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Exactly. And it's very cute. And then that's where we leave this chapter.
The dust pouring from the stars had found a living home again, and these children, no longer children, saturated with love, were the cause of it all.
Oh, I love that. That's so great.
It's so cute.
So cute. Yeah, I feel like this chapter, it's funny because I enjoyed Gomez's death because it was so stupid.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like I wanted to like revel more in what happened with Lyra and Will and what that meant. So I think what you were saying about how it's like split up in a weird way. For me, almost, it should have been in another chapter, the Gomez stuff.
Yeah.
It felt like almost the Lyra and Will stuff warranted, like the first kiss of Lyra and Will, I feel warrants its own chapter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Phil has a habit of doing this though, because there's a few things that have been snuck into chapters that have had like multiple story arcs.
Yeah.
That we've been like, wait, this is where they fall into the abyss and it's not got its own entire chapter all to itself, or like,
and like
this
we were saying when we were trying to find the chapter where they separate and it's called the Harpies, and it's interesting.
And so there's just some things that I feel like deserve to be put on their own chapter. And it's almost like, I get that Will and Lyra having this beautiful carefree exploration hide and seek with their demon situation, adding an element of menace, it works well in the TV series for that, in terms of we can see the kids and you can, in a TV show, you can accept these two things are happening simultaneously.
Yeah.
But don't know about each other. And I wouldn't have appreciated it all being woven together. I don't want Gomez to be in the same paragraph as Lyra and Will kissing. That would be worse.
Yeah.
But like, I don't love that he gets to share a chat. I don't feel like it needed to happen simultaneously. We could have canned him sooner.
No.
And then just had a nice chapter with Lyra and Will getting to smooch. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. For sure. What is the next chapter called then, Rich?
The Broken Arrow.
Oh, I have no idea what's going to happen.
Well, I believe that it's from like POV of the demons. Because the first three words are the two demons. So,
oh, I hope so. Yeah. I've missed Pam.
Yeah.
So, who is your award for?
Who do I choose? Obviously, it's for Father Gomez. No.
Can we give it to Father Gomez's death?
Yeah. Well, in which case you give it to Balthamos.
Well, right? I'll just spoil mine. Mine is for Balthamos.
Amazing.
Yeah.
In which case I'll give mine as like a joint award to the kids for their smooching.
Yeah.
Yes. It's just cute because they were just honest about their feelings. And then it's like the ultimate like earnest cringe award. Like the exact right amount of being a cringy teenager.
Yeah,
that makes me want to cry because it's so damn cute.
Yeah, I feel like more people should get awards for smooching.
Yeah, I mean, yes, always. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Her Dark Materials. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at HDMPod, and you can email us at herdarkmaterialspod@gmail.com. You can also visit our website at hdmpod.co.uk.
If you want to support us, you can become a patron at patreon.com/HDMPod. We also have a shop where you can buy merch featuring all original artwork from Rach. You can find it at hdmpod.co.uk/shop. I'm Faye, and when I'm not talking about smooching, you can find me talking about Paramore on my other podcast, Still Into You. You can listen wherever you get your podcasts and find us on Twitter and Instagram at StillIntoYouPod.
I'm Rachel, and when I'm not here chatting to you lovely folks about gorgeously adorable teenage cringe, I'm making cute and magical arty things. You can find me over on Instagram at RachMakes, on Twitter and TikTok at Rach_makes, and over on my online shop, rachmakes.co.uk. The theme music for the podcast was written and produced by Johnny Knopp.
And we'll see you in 2 weeks' time. And don't forget,
keep telling stories,
and all will be well.
Someone that you fancy.
I was literally just going to say those exact same words.
Oh my God.
Go and smooch.
Yes.